said of Joe Lewis, a symbol of the way that we can have some form of justice and equality in our society.
Dave Zirin, the thoughts on the who's giving the eulogy, which I think is what Muhammad Ali wanted, but President Clinton, Billy Crystal, Bryant Gumbel?
Well, first of all, Bryant Gumbel is one of the most lucid analysts of Muhammad Ali's history. It's Bryant Gumbel who said that Muhammad Ali allowed the black freedom struggle to move forward because he made people less afraid. Billy Crystal, a longtime friend of Muhammad Ali. I'll be honest, the Bill Clinton, the presence there, it honestly does hurt, given Muhammad Ali's historic place as a great figure against war and against bigotry, to have the person who signed the welfare bill, the person who signed the crime bill, the person who was in charge of the sanctions in Iraq. It will be painful to see him up there. But in many ways, in some respects, that is Muhammad Ali's last victory. The same presidents that used to bug his phone and harass him and subject him to COINTELPRO now
have to
stand over his body.
Dave Zirin and Dalia Mugahed, I want to thank you so much for being with us. This does it for our show. They were speaking to us from Louisville. I'll be in Chicago Saturday, June 11th, Jones College Prep at 3 for the 2016 Printers Row Literary Festival. That does it for the broadcast. We have two job openings at Democracy Now! Check them out. Special thanks to Amy Littlefield and Carla Wills.
KBOO Portland. The time is now 5 p.m. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
Tune in Thursday, June 16th at 10 p.m. for another special live remote broadcast from What the Festival at the Wolf Run Ranch. Once again, we'll be showcasing the musical and visual artists at this year's festival with interviews, music, and interactions with the producers and the participants, exploring what makes this such a uniquely immersive and entertaining festival. Again, be sure to tune in on Thursday, June 16th at 10 p.m. for our What the Festival broadcast. More information can be found on the KBOO website under Community Events.
Check it out, baby. If the funk gets too hot for your rump, turn the other cheek, bump. Yeah.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, The Case of the Three-Sided Dream, showing Wednesday, June 15th at 7 p.m. The Case of the Three-Sided Dream tells the story of a multi-instrumentalist, Rashawn Roland Kirk, who went from a blind infant to a child prodigy to adult visionary to a political activist and finally to a paralyzed showman. Kirk was a seemingly superhuman musical force who played literally until the day he died. Again, that's The Case of the Three-Sided Dream, Wednesday, June 15th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the law enforcement ramming of the Golden Rule Peace Boat on the Willamette River last night may trigger a lawsuit.
This week, Multnomah County Library announced they are eliminating late fees for youth books.
The Russian performance artist was released from custody after being found guilty of damaging cultural heritage.
Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 10th, 2016. I'm Natasha Delapine.
And I'm Liam Delta. Last night, the KBOO News reported that law enforcement boats at the Rose Festival for Fleet Week stopped the Golden Rule, a peace boat, here to raise awareness of the threat of nuclear weapons. Today, at least one activist organization say they plan to sue one of the law enforcement agencies for knocking a hole in the peace boat. Veterans for Peace organizer said on Facebook today that the ramming was apparently due to, quote, incompetence of the Washington County Sheriff's pilot rather than an intentional attack. The Golden Rule's crew says that the damage is deep but won't hurt its seaworthiness, and they'll be out on the Willamette during the Rose Parade Saturday. Anti-nuclear activists are calling for Kai activists to take to the water this weekend to protest the presence of nuclear warships on the Willamette and the threat to the Golden Rule. The Golden Rule is an historic sailing ship that traveled in 1958 into the Pacific Ocean to protest atmospheric nuclear testing. KBOO spoke with Mimi Gurman, co-founder of No Nukes Northwest, about what happened and what's next.
Yesterday, representing No Nukes Northwest, I went out on the Golden Rule to protest the warships coming in for Fleet Week. During the time that we were out there, we were in contact with many of the police boats who needed to tell us things like when we could travel, when it was safe to go under the bridges, when the bridge would be raised, and to get escort from the police services that were out there to keep everybody safe. That was fine. It was very clear. We left the marina at 1 o'clock, and at 5:15 in the afternoon, we were waiting to return to the dock. We were on the west side of the steel bridge when our boat was intentionally, I don't know if it was intentionally hit, but in the action of aggression by the Washington County Sheriff's boat, they hit us. They rammed into our boat. And they gouged a hole in the starboard side of the boat. At least three of us, were standing at exactly the point at which the Washington County's boat hit us. It was Harvey Wasserman of Solartopia, myself, and Helen Jeckard, who is running things for this entire project for the Golden Rule. There were others on board. I don't remember who else was on top of the boat watching all of this happen, but we watched this entire thing happen. We watched the boat speed up and come directly at us, and they couldn't stop. One of the men on the boat shouted right before they hit us, "Don't hit them," and they hit us. And they came back around without mentioning the fact that they had hit us, without asking if everybody was okay, without talking about damage to our boat, and told us that they were going to come on board and search the boat. It was a completely inappropriate thing to say in that moment. And I think Helen responded by saying, "We need your insurance. And you hit our boat." And, you know, trying to figure out what just happened with them. So anyway, this morning I decided that No Nukes Northwest, since I was on the boat, has a right to sue the Washington County Sheriff's Department for doing that. And I decided that I was going to take that action. I spoke with Robert McCulloch this morning about this, and we're going to find a lawyer to represent our case. I'm not pursuing this case from No Nukes Northwest with the Golden Rule. The Golden Rule is a separate entity from us, and they're going to do what they're going to do. We'll know soon enough what their actions are going to be. I just want it clear that I'm not speaking at all for the Golden Rule. I am speaking for No Nukes Northwest. What I've decided as well from No Nukes Northwest is that we need to get, first of all, right away, we need people to come into the waters this weekend and protest the boats. We need our Kai activists to get active. There was one Kai activist out there yesterday. I remember her as a Kai activist when we were all in the water for preventing the Fenneca from getting back out. And I made contact with her. I asked her if she was okay because she'd been surrounded by about 3 to 4 police boats off and on who were harassing her but ended up leaving her alone. We stayed in contact for part of this.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving. This week, Multnomah County Libraries announced they are eliminating late fees for youth books. KBOO spoke with library staff about how it's going to work and what's on tap for kids this summer at the library.
I'm Lisa Loving, KBOO Evening News. We're talking with Sean Cunningham about this groundbreaking decision by Multnomah County Library to stop charging late fees for youth books. Sean, how do we define what fees are going to be charged and which ones are not? Is it youth books or books checked out by youths?
Actually, this applies to both youth materials and to youth accounts. So beginning on June 15th, Multnomah County Library will stop assessing fines for late returns of youth materials and for youth accounts. The library still will ensure that patrons return their materials by billing patrons for unreturned materials after a period of time.
Okay. Do you mean like if the things just completely go missing?
Right. So the library has a range of different services we provide people. If they have lost materials, we really encourage folks to just stop by a library, give us a call, or shoot us an email, and we're happy to work with patrons on account-related issues. And sometimes people lose books. We understand that. But in essence, patrons are responsible for taking care of the materials they check out. So if people don't return materials, then eventually the replacement cost of that item will be billed to the patron's library account.
So you set it up that way to give people a break, but also ensure that there's some accountability with your materials not going into a vortex.
Right. The library, the public library, is a steward of public resources, and that includes our books and everything else in the library's collection. So one of our duties is to make sure that those materials are available for people to use. So it's incumbent on people who borrow library books and other materials to return them so that others in the community can use them. If people don't return materials for 30 days after a due date, then the library will bill that account for the replacement cost of that item. However, if the patron finds the book under a bed, in a closet, that sort of thing, we're happy to resolve that issue on the patron's account.
Sean, what made the library system decide to do this? Why is it an important issue?
Mm-hmm. Well, really, it's an issue of equity and access. There are approximately 8,400 library accounts right now that belong to people under the age of 18 or that are blocked because of overdue fines related to youth materials. And so essentially what's happening for those people is that they're excluded from using the library services. For a lot of families, this means that they won't come and use the library, and often that's happening during a time of really critical learning and development for children. So we're trying to take a step to make the library a more inclusive place and just welcome those people, the children, the families, everyone back to Multnomah County Library.
Sean, are there other inclusive steps that perhaps the library management is taking as well? Is this part of a bigger strategy?
Well, we're always trying to be responsive to the needs of our community, and our community is evolving and changing rapidly. So really, I would say that it's a process of continual evaluation of how we do our work, and looking at different ways that we can provide materials in our collection, programs, services that are responsive to the needs of our community. So we offer books and other items, programs, and then staff members who speak Spanish, Russian, Vietnamese, Chinese, and Somali. That's one of the ways, and we are always looking for ways that we can be of better service to our community.
Okay, Sean, just because I have you on the phone, it's sure. The beginning of summer. What is the most important thing for Portland area families or families anywhere to remember about their public library?
Well, we're beginning our summer reading program on June 17th. Multnomah County Library's summer reading program is one of the oldest and largest in the nation. Last year, we had about 110,000 babies, kids, and teens participate. So really, we just would love to have everyone come visit the library, get a game board if you haven't received one through your child's school, and they can really read at a level that is appropriate for their pace, for their skill. They can find materials that are of high interest to them, and they can earn prizes. They can earn books. They can even get earn tickets to see the Trailblazers, the Timbers 2, the Portland Pickles, or the Portland Thorn.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. On this date in 1963, the Equal Pay Act of 1963 was signed into law by President John F. Kennedy. The law was part of his New Frontier program. It was aimed at abolishing wage disparity based on gender. President Kennedy said, quote, "I am delighted to approve the Equal Pay Act of 1963, which prohibits arbitrary discrimination against women in the payment of wages. This act represents many years of effort to call attention to the unconscionable practice of paying female employees less wages than male employees doing the same job," unquote. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather, partly cloudy with a high of 68 and possible afternoon showers. East of the Cascades and Hood River, you can expect partly cloudy skies with a high of 71.
The U.S. Department of Justice has proposed a new rule that would exempt the FBI Next Generation Identification System, purportedly the world's largest biometric database, from key provisions of the Privacy Act. The information in the database goes far beyond mugshots and fingerprints of convicted criminals. FSRN's Shannon Young spoke with Jeremy Scott, a national security attorney with the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, and director of its Domestic Surveillance Project.
Can you first explain specifically what provisions of the Privacy Act the FBI is seeking to exempt its next generation identification system from, and what the implications would be for ordinary Americans?
Sure. So the FBI wants broad exemptions for NGI to avoid the Privacy Act requirements of accuracy, relevancy and necessity, accounting disclosures, individual access to records, and civil remedies. So, you know, what that means is they're not obligated to necessarily keep accurate records. They can collect whatever information they want. It doesn't have to be relevant. It doesn't have to be necessary. And they don't have to allow individuals access to those records so the individual can actually see whether the information kept by the FBI is accurate. And they want to exempt themselves for civil remedies. So if the FBI ends up using inaccurate information, which focuses their attention on you, and disrupts your life, you no longer would have a civil remedy in that case.
One of the concerns that has been raised about this database in particular is that it stores biometric information on individuals who have not been convicted of a crime. This could include people who have submitted personal information for employment-related background checks or people who have been wrongfully arrested. What current mechanisms exist for non-criminal individuals who would like to have some modicum of control over their biometric data?
Legally speaking, there's not a lot of law in place to help you control your biometric information. If you're out in the street and someone takes a picture of a crowd, they can use facial recognition to identify you. You know, fingerprint left in public, that can be used at will. So there's not a lot of law there to help kind of control and set limits in terms of collection, use, storage, and sharing of biometric information. And what the FBI is trying to do now is basically remove any sort of kind of public oversight with respect to this very, very large biometric database.
Specifically in a law enforcement context, police in some jurisdictions take DNA samples from people they arrest at protests. And while the charges that provided the basis for the arrest may eventually be dropped, the biometric data of the DNA sample remains in a database. Is there a way for someone who was wrongfully arrested, for example, to make sure that data is scrubbed?
In the context of an arrest, I'm not sure you can have it removed at all, potentially even in the case where you're arrested and charges are dropped. Now, you keep in mind that means there's a whole lot of people who participate in civil disobedience and other protest actions who are then arrested, whose information then gets entered into NGI. And that information is then kept for decades. until I think the person turns like 100 or 110 or something like that. It's a very long time that they keep this information.
Your organization, EPIC, sued the FBI in 2013 over access to information pertaining to the Next Generation Identification Database. What were some of the key points of information that came out as a result of that legal action?
Well, one of the key documents got were the technical specifications for NGI. And what it showed is that the FBI is willing to accept a 20% error rate with their facial recognition searches. Now, that error rate, that's a pretty large error rate. Now, they do have people review the results of the searches. So that means that's potentially a lot of people who are then kind of flagged for the FBI to look at.
With that 20% error rate across the general population, there are also specific populations that run a higher risk for being falsely flagged, correct?
Yes, this is correct. So the error rate I'm talking about is within the technical specifications, the FBI basically said we're willing to accept a 20% error rate on the facial recognition searches that are run. So 20% of the time, you know, the result they get back is not actually a match for the facial recognition search. But there has been some work done to look at the success of facial recognition across different ethnicities, and with certain minority groups, facial recognition is actually worse in terms of its ability to identify a proper match.
Jeremy Scott is a national security attorney and director of the Domestic Surveillance Project at the Electronic Privacy Information Center. He joined us by phone from Washington, D.C. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
Yesterday, a Russian performance artist was released from custody after being found guilty of damaging cultural heritage. Pyotr Pavlensky was fined the equivalent of $8,000 for setting fire to the front door of the headquarters of the FSB, Russia's Internal Security Service. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman has more.
Nighttime in Moscow. A fire is burning in the doorway of a large building. A man is standing in front of the fire with his legs apart, and two people stand in front of him watching as if puzzling over a painting. After a short while, a uniformed officer walks up and forcibly leads the man away. That was Ugroza, or Threat, the latest piece by one of Russia's most notorious performance artists, Pyotr Pavlensky. The building is the Lubyanka, a massive edifice in Moscow that is currently the headquarters of the FSB, Russia's Internal Security Service, and the successor to the KGB. Pavlensky was arrested after the performance last November and only released yesterday after being found guilty of destruction of cultural heritage. Pavlensky claimed that the trial itself was an extension of the piece, with his role reduced to that of an observer while the state and its various enforcers took center stage. He said the purpose of the piece was to make it clear to people that they lived under, quote, uninterrupted terror in Vladimir Putin's Russia, a point driven home by the choice of the Lubyanka as his target. The building has been headquarters of the state security apparatus under its various names since the beginning of the Soviet Union, when Felix Dzerzhinsky founded the Emergency Commission, known by its acronym CHECA. Through countless name changes, from the OGPU to the NKVD to the KGB and now the FSB, dissident Russians still contemptuously refer to its agents as Chekists. A dark Soviet joke from the height of the Gulag years calls the Lubyanka the tallest building in Russia because you can see Siberia from its basement. Thousands of political dissidents were imprisoned, questioned, tortured, and often shot in the building. At Pavlensky's trial, the prosecution made the case that he destroyed cultural heritage because of all the famous dissidents held within its walls during the Soviet era. The defense called two of those Soviet-era prisoners to testify on Pavlensky's behalf, less a legal argument than an extension of the performance piece. Pavlensky spent much of the trial in the back of the courtroom, confined in a metal cage. The judge found the defense, quote, incoherent, and fined Pavlensky $500,000 rubles, or just under $8,000 US, plus a similar amount in damages to replace the door. Pavlensky was released to cheers on Wednesday and refused to pay either the fine or the damages, and asked that his supporters not pay it for him. Pavlensky first came to prominence in 2011 when he sewed his lips shut in protest after the imprisonment of three members of the feminist performance art group Pussy Riot. Many observers think that his comparatively light sentence was an attempt by the Russian authorities to avoid a repeat of the international reaction to the Pussy Riot decision. Since that time, Pavlensky has nailed his scrotum to Red Square, wrapped his naked body in barbed wire, cut off his earlobe, and set a pile of tires on fire in what he describes as attempts to drive home how state repression destroys people's humanity. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
For the next 3 weeks, the KBOO News Department has the opportunity to host Davlat Beydoula of the Tajik News Service of Dushanbe, Tajikistan. KBOO's Theo Burke had the opportunity to speak with Davlat in his stay in the U.S. and what Americans should know about his Eastern Asian homeland.
And I'm here with Dalachur Badilo, the news director of the Tajiki News Service, part of the Asia Plus station and media company in Tajikistan. And Dalachur, known as Dalat, is here on a fellowship from the International Center for Journalism.
I have been selected for a 4-week fellowship for broadcaster journalists for Central Asian countries.
Okay.
As you notice, it's organized by International Center for Journalists. The first week in Washington, D.C., we attended workshops, 2-day workshops, mm-hmm. and we visited many places, media organizations, mm-hmm. Such as The Voice of America and NBC News.
One of the reasons you were assigned to KBOO was because of the alternative style of journalism practiced here?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yes, because I had that the KBOO community radio, they have just alternative style of covering news. They have their own style, and they mostly cover local news rather than international. They just assigned me to be aware of how this radio station covers local news. So okay. It's very important for me.
You were telling me that there's a lot of music, but you do have news radio at mainly through hourly bulletins during the day.
Okay, I work for local radio called Asia Plus. It's part of media company Asia Plus, and our radio run on air bulletins on Tajik and Russian. In day per day, maybe. Beginning from 6 a.m. till 6 p.m. Asia Plus Media Company, it consists of radio, where I'm working now, news agency, newspaper, magazine, and TV production.
And you told me it is privately owned, actually by a man in Washington, D.C. owns it.
Oh, yeah.
It's independent, but you have to be careful about, you have to watch out for government oversight or possible censorship or blocking?
Oh, in case of blocking, I should notice sometimes when our news agency just covers stories or news that government, for example, don't want its publication, they just block our website.
Block the website.
Yeah.
And then that hurts your advertising revenue.
Yeah, it's have negative effects to advertising revenue.
What do Americans need to know about Tajikistan?
Yeah, Tajikistan is one of the Central Asian countries which bordering with Afghanistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and China. So it's 93% of Tajikistan consists of mountains.
No,
from 1992 till 1997, there were in Tajikistan civil war, which had a negative effect to economy, social life of people of Tajikistan.
Well, we look forward to hearing your work over the next 3 weeks and learning a lot from you. So we thank Dalachur Badilla.
Yeah.
For talking to us today, and more to come. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032, extension 203. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell, Sam Bowman, John Pascio, and Jenna Yokoyama. The producer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Emery Mort, me, Natasha Delapine, and Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Ian Gadwell. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Paloma on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Natasha Delapine.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Cecil and Celeste focus on the Jubilee movement and the cancellation of odious and illegitimate debt that many developing nations face. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Locus Focus presents an encore broadcast of Once They Were Hats, In Search of the Mighty Beaver. Barbara Bernstein speaks with writer Francis Backhouse. At 11 on Health Watch, Ellen Goldsmith interviews Delaney Rustin, physician and filmmaker, about her documentary Screenagers. It looks for solutions on how we can empower kids to best navigate the digital world. And at 11:30, Health and Healthcare Forum presents Eating for Health with nutritionist Anne Marchant. She looks at how the